Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Oops.
I turned the music off.
Oh, cool. Okay. Until we get
to Conservative Talk Radio, my name is Tracy.
And I'm just plain Bill.
And it's just plain quiet. We need some music.
Yes.
We need music. Let's play this one.
Oh, yeah, I like that. On my front porch.
On the front porch. did you get this? Did you hear this thing? Is it Backus that went after Palin over the weekend for ruining the Senate, the GOP's chances for controlling the Senate?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
He wants Senate Finance Chair.
Yeah. Yeah.
Brilliant man. Brilliant man. I think
Brilliant.
We should put him in charge of money. That's a good idea.
Oh, man.
Earth to the GOP, the last person you want to be bashing right now or anytime in the near future is Sarah Palin.
Yep. That and Michelle Bachmann. I forget who it was that was ragging on her today, but or yesterday, I guess, but they were. And it's like,
oh,
God,
stupid.
Guys.
Stupid boy.
Give us a break here. I mean,
you know, we could have won the Senate. Wouldn't have been for her. You wouldn't
yeah.
have won the House except for her.
Yeah, well, the other thing
huh?
is, somebody has a blog post out on how the cocktail party GOP cost the Senate 5 seats. And one of the examples that they give is on Carly Fiorina. Now, Carly Fiorina was not a Tea Party candidate. She
right.
had talked a good game, but she was not a Tea Party candidate. The Tea Party was supporting Chuck DeVore out here in California. But, oh, no, they got Carly Fiorina. Oh, yeah, you bet. She's great. You bet. And in the last, I don't know, week and a half of the campaign, dumped $5 million on her campaign and still lost. Now, I wonder how
far
that...
Well, you can't win in California without unless you have a moderate conservative.
That's right. Now, I wonder how much that $5 million would have gone for to get, oh, say, Ken Buck in Colorado, who lost by a very small margin. I wonder what that would have done.
Joe Miller in Alaska?
Oh, yeah. You betcha. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't have a lot of sympathy for these cocktail party GOPers who say, oh, God, y'all cost us the Senate. Or we could have had bigger gains in the House. It's like, guys, you people are living in fantasy land.
Well, that's what happens when, you know, you live your life listening to the to the Democrats as
mm-hmm.
Your source of intelligent considerations.
Yeah.
How was that New York Times thing?
Oops.
I want the decisions on the New York Times. Remember that page we had?
Oh, yeah. Well, you had it. I was using somebody else just to try to get a different... Actually, I was using Politico, I think.
Let's see if I can find it.
Okay.
I
found it either someplace.
Find out how well we did. I won.
Yeah, you did. big time.
I won.
I was, I don't know, 12 seats off.
Well, no, I mean, you know, I think you said 55.
Yep. And we got, what, 67?
Well, that's what I wanted to find out, exactly what the what the final was here.
Well, and remember that we still have got some races left to be decided yet. I mean, Harmer here in California.
Yeah, Senate. New York Times, Washington Night, New York Coverage, Media Leader. Come on. Where's this page? Come on. I hate to do this in this quiet time we have sitting in here, but I do want to get. Well, see, now I don't know if this has been updated or not. When was the last time this was updated? It shows 60-plus seats with 7 undecided.
No, that wasn't updated then, because the last number that I recall was in decided races. There were 65 sure things.
Stop it.
So that must not have been updated.
Holly, shut up. Yeah, this is can't be. Man, there's an awful lot of red there.
Yeah, there certainly is. You know, the other thing that came out of that while you're kind of mousing around there, the GOP controls either outright, both House, Senate, and governor, or governor in either House or Senate, or governor in 33 states. That has some incredible implications in terms of redistricting.
Yes, I consider that probably more important last week than just about anything else.
Yep. What was it? 585 state legislative offices. It was some number very much like that.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with it. Except well, of course, you know, we don't know the quality of those Republican.
No.
Although,
don't.
Let's face it, at the more local levels, they're more likely to be either captive of their business interests, which I'm not inclined to be overly concerned by. I don't like necessarily them being captured by the business interests. Right now, it's probably a good thing, but...
Yeah, I agree.
In Wisconsin, the business interests are very much aligned with a Rhino point of view.
Oh, really? Okay.
They absolutely want to manage the political process. They assume they're going to lose it, so they want to manage it. And you know, it's part and parcel with the weakness of the Republican Party in the Wisconsin area. You know, that I was dealing with, that you and I have talked about in the past, that I dealt with putting up just absolutely. Idiot, candidates. In any case, not to get into that, I mean, Wisconsin is one of those states that has gone seriously red. The state legislature and the governor are now Republican, and one of the two senators are Republican, first time that's happened in a while.
Yes, indeed.
So I'm very happy to see Feingold gone. Victoria's not.
Yeah, well. Oh, well.
He's not here. I can do that a little bit. Jenny doesn't listen to the show, so I can get away with that. By the way, just for general knowledge, she was discharged from the hospital on Friday. She is now in the skilled nursing facility for a couple more weeks to deal with rehab and finishing up the course of antibiotics.
Cool.
It was not an eventful week. They tried to kill her on Thursday.
Oh, geez.
Wednesday night and Thursday, she almost reached the point where she needed to do a blood transfusion because she was laying in a puddle of her own. It was just clusterfuck. I mean, you know, one stupid act after another. And let me tell you, I unloaded on that hospital on Thursday. Unloaded. Director of nursing and director of the chief surgeon both ended up in the room on Thursday afternoon, and I don't know that they've heard that much vulgarity, you know, in a work environment. You know, it started out with the recovery room came up on Thursday to do a patient satisfaction summary with how she was treated post-surgically Wednesday night.
Yeah.
And I looked at her, and Victoria looked at me. She smiled and closed her eyes. And I turned to her, and I said, "Do you by any chance have a marker?" And she goes, "Well, yes." I said, "Okay, a nice big black one?" She goes, "Yes." I said, "Good. I want you to take that Big Mac marker, and see that line where it says very unsatisfied? I want you to draw a big, huge line down all through, right through all of those. Mark every one of them very unsatisfied. And I want you to put little stars and asterisks and exclamation marks, and then I want you to write this. You getting this?" She goes, "Yeah." I go, "Fucking morons." I said, "That's our satisfaction survey. I strongly suggest that you push it uphill really fast. I'm not yelling at you. You weren't there. But I suggest that you leave now and go find hires."
There you go.
And about 20 minutes later, I had two people who were not in hospital garb, but wearing suits and ties, well, dressed in suit and tie. And they said, "We heard that there was a problem." I said, "Yeah, your post-op team, you know, fucked up in the worst way and, you know, practically killed my partner." Now, I'm not saying that that would have happened, but given the fact that she came up here with uncontrolled bleeding.
Yeah.
You know, dumping her into the floor nurse, you know, who sat here with my help and a student nurse, you know, going through gauze so fast that, did you know that this floor ran out of gauze last night because we were trying to stop the bleeding?
Ouch.
And I said, "So, you know, for a hospital that prides itself on protocol, you guys fucked up so bad that you're lucky I'm not. You're lucky I am talking to you."
Yeah, really. Instead of suing you.
You know. Anyways, after about 10 minutes of profuse apologies, they left. I wasn't polite. And Victoria said, "Did you have to use those words?" I said, "No, but I wanted to make sure the tone was understood."
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
I don't think anybody on this floor got any problem with what the tone was.
Yeah. Yep.
I wasn't. I wasn't polite. I was vulgar. I was mean, and I was pissed off. By the way, the nurse who did a stellar job at stopping the bleeding.
Yeah.
I proceeded to tell her, the charge nurse, who was the nurse on charge of the floor that night, and the head of nursing, who I saw at the same, all three at the same time, that she screwed up, and that while I absolutely appreciated and stood by her for what she did and the outstanding work that she did in you know, dealing with Victoria, she screwed up. And I told the charge nurse, I said, "You know, you walked away, and frankly, you screwed up."
Mm-hmm.
You had a nurse that was working for 45 minutes in a room with one patient with blood up to her elbows, and you walked up twice and said, "Do you need any help?" And both times she said, "I'm just trying to stop the bleeding," and both times you walked away.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm telling you right now, that was a mistake, a bad mistake. And I'm telling the nurse, who I think did an outstanding job, she made a mistake by not turning to you and saying, "I need help, and I need lots of it now."
Yep.
Victoria was on Percocets and morphine every 2 hours for the next 40 hours.
Whoa.
2 hours, every 2 hours, for 40 hours before she could even start reaching a point where if the pain medicine was late, she wasn't crying.
Ow.
You know, I mean, they put a 10-pound sandbag on her stomach to try and stop the bleeding, to keep pressure on it, hard pressure on it.
Yep.
You know.
Yep.
And I, you just sit there and kind of go crazy. Anyways. There was two points of view for me today as far as tonight's show is concerned. You know, we've been talking about politics, and this is a politics show. That's what we do. We talk about politics.
Yep.
And a lot of the radio shows I've been listening to for the last couple of days have tried to be doing anything but politics. Everybody's burnt out on politics at this point. You know,
yep.
Nobody wants to get into fights that are going to go on soon enough. I thought about some of the things that have been going on, and the problem is there are lots of things still going on politics-wise. And
oh, yeah.
Fortunately for me, for most of the last 7 days, you know, I've been dealing with Victoria. I haven't had much time. You know, I've taken some time to work, but I've spent a significant amount of time with Victoria. But I'm going to tell you some things about some of these nurses and doctors that I've been talking to in the last 5 days. Okay, I want you to understand that, one, I think on the floor, and I said this to the director of nursing, I have this to say about the nurses that are on this floor. I said, we've been here 18 days, and we have had approximately 43 or 44 nurses. And with one exception, only one exception, they have been uniformly great. And I want to single out, and I named three who I thought did outstanding work.
Mm-hmm.
I said, amazing staff. I said, I don't have any use for the doctors. You know, my problem with the doctors at this point is, with two exceptions, I got no use for them, the hospital doctors. They're a pain in the ass. They weren't useful. They create as many problems as to the CNA, the support staff for the nursing, I said, much bigger problems with consistency there. I said there were probably about half were good, about a third were, okay to barely tolerable. I said there was probably about 15% that were flat out mediocre, including the one on Wednesday night while one nurse is trying to stop the bleeding who took the vitals and then disappeared.
Oh, my God.
You know, flat, disappeared. I never saw her again that evening. You know, I don't know what we're going to do, but we're going to have a conversation with somebody because this was just flat ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
So, we got a chance to talk to probably half of the nursing staff and, other people that were in there. And I want to tell you how they feel about Obamacare.
Uh-oh.
Because this was actually something that I wanted to find out from people that deal with, the medical system every day.
Sure.
Okay. And generally, everybody understood pretty soon that, Victoria was, most people didn't understand Victoria was liberal, but, in a discussion with them, but there's no doubt where I was coming from and just about anything. But uniformly, I would say it was probably better than 90% thought Obamacare was the worst thing that could possibly happen to medical care.
Yep. I don't doubt that. I haven't had any conversations with medical professionals since all that came down, but my guess is that I would find probably about the same thing.
Now, I want to qualify that. Without exception, every one of them wanted some version of national health care.
Really,
without exception. There wasn't one of them that complained about Obamacare that didn't flat out say that they wanted some version of national health care.
Huh.
And their issues were that too much of how they take care of patients is dictated by the dollars. And all of them believed that a national healthcare system where profit is taken out of the system, and insurance and otherwise would be beneficial for client care.
Huh.
Now, what I found interesting about that is that in the probably half a dozen that I actually got a chance to talk a little bit in depth with about that, all of them were clueless about the idea of what's going on with Medicare. I mean, they understood Medicare was a problem, but they absolutely believed that it was fixable. It was fixable.
Just to clarify, what they wanted was the profit taken out. Is that right?
Right. They believed that insurance companies and the hospitals were oriented in cost containment or profit maximization, and in both cases, those two, while directly opposing each other in general, both detrimental to client care, patient care.
Well, what about those doctors making $400,000 or $500,000 or $600,000 a year? You want to take that out too?
You know, I don't know how they felt about that.
Well, I'm trying to extrapolate here and say, okay, you want profit taken out of it. And, okay, so let's explore that for a second. So you're saying, gosh, hospitals ought not to make a profit, clinics ought not to make a profit, including the standalone urgent care clinics. Insurance companies ought not to make a profit. And I'm sitting here wondering, well, where in the world do they think they're going to get the capital to start those companies up if there's not profits?
I find it interesting because we're back into a skilled nursing facility. And the attitude towards Victoria this time is considerably different than it was in August. Now there's they're practically fawning over her, trying to deal with different services. Now what's the difference between the SNF in August and the SNF now? Well, she was covered by private insurance before, and she's covered by Medicare now.
And Medicare on SNFs gives a higher reimbursement.
Much higher repayment thing.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I saw was she has a little IV pole for her antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little tick for it that says rental fee.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so so they're charging a rental fee for the IV pole in the room.
Isn't that interesting?
It is clear from, we in California, there's a whole lot of disconnect. We'll talk about that in a second.
Yeah.
It is clear from the response of Obama and the Democrats, and even most of the elite Republicans, that they haven't got a clue 18 months on what the Tea Party is about. Not at all. And worse yet, I'm not certain that the Tea Parties understand exactly how much what they're saying needs to be applied in a way that goes well beyond what most of them think is appropriate. Victoria is charged, and Medicare is charged, because now in the SNF she has to be transported to dialysis because they don't do it in the facility. Victoria will be charged, on average, $2,200 per trip to the dialysis clinic for the transportation, which is about 2 miles away.
Yeah.
What I found rather interesting was today she had to have a little procedure done at the hospital. Now, our facility that she's in is across the street. To be precise, from starting point to ending point was 0.3 mile.
Oh, God.
Okay. They had to call for an ambulance. Two guys had to pick her up, bring her into the ambulance, drive across the street, take her out, bring her in, you know, bring her back out, cross the street, stuff like that. And I'm going to tell you right now that the charge for today for going for that little trip is probably going to be something in the vicinity of $2,000.
Wow.
Now, I don't care what metric you want to use. Okay? That cost is just flat ridiculous.
Oh, yeah.
Now, I understand they're trained EMTs with the equipment to back them up.
Sure.
Okay? But $2,000 for a 0.3-mile drive?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
if I were to say today that we could cut Medicare by 40% with no loss in care, there wouldn't be a single solitary person that would believe me, except for the people that handle the billing for Medicare,
mm-hmm.
would probably look at me and say, you could probably go further.
Wow. Wow.
Holly. So, the costs are just in the stratosphere. And there's no good reason for it. There is no good reason for it. I can't imagine why, other than the fact that the government is involved in it, why it's that high.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You know, what could it be that would cause that? And, she's also likely to be in a situation where that little procedure that she had today probably cost $2,000 or $3,000.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm just finding the situation to be eye-opening. I mean, I assumed that there was waste in government, and you and I have talked about the idea that one of the reasons we spend so much money on medical care here is because the government has screwed with the numbers so badly,
yes,
that there's no hope of getting something, reasonable when you want to think about it. All right, let's talk about that for a second. Because I think you understand it. Maybe nobody else does. This is going to take 2 minutes.
Okay.
If something costs $1,000 and the hospital does 10 of them, that would be $10,000.
Yes, it would.
If those 10 procedures, 4 of them were done to patients on Medicare, and Medicare only paid 80%, $320 of those charges would not be paid by Medicare, despite the hospital needing to spend $10,000 to do them.
True.
That means the six remaining have to make up the difference of that $320. Or in this case, they have to pay about $50-odd more each in order to get the same procedure,
mm-hmm.
because Medicare didn't do it.
Right.
Now, if you carry this down with a few iterations, such as, Medicare is reimbursing too high, so they reduce the reimbursement rate to 60% instead of 80%, and they end up with higher costs associated to the people that are paying versus the Medicare people.
Mm-hmm.
Problem is, Medicare tends to reimburse less over time for the same procedures.
True.
So they might have been reimbursing 60% for, appendix removal 10 years ago, but now they're only going to do 40%. So it's not just, a general reduction, it's specific also. Anyways, as the cost continues to go up, insurers start passing those costs on to everyone else, and then they start hammering out their own deals with the hospitals that, of course, reduce the rates for them, but that means the hospital just transfers those rates on to somebody else.
Absolutely. Cost shifting.
those distortions over the last 30 years have reached points where, you know, it's the equivalent of Medicare paying $100, the insurers paying $700, and everyone else paying $25,000.
Yep.
You know, and people wonder why, you know, if you don't have insurance, the insurance company looks at that $25,000 and goes, I don't want to pay that. Even though they've worked out agreements to pay only $800.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is the system they want everybody to have?
Yeah, right. Now, me, thank you very much.
Well, and that doesn't even, I mean, that talks about payment mechanisms. That doesn't even get into, you know, what about all of the issues of rationing, if you will, of health care. I mean, it doesn't even touch that. All we're talking about right now is, well, okay, so what's the reimbursement mechanism? And it's not all that great.
Right, and, you know, most of that reimbursement mechanism just drives hospitals and doctors to inflate their fees.
Yep.
In order to, you know, increase their reimbursement rates.
Exactly.
And that just drives the next rate, you know, group of, you know, reductions in the reimbursement rates. It is a, you know, a vicious little cycle. I am seeing people in the SNF that have been dumped by families, by the system.
Yeah.
People that are not being, you know, they're being cared for, but in the most minimalist of ways.
Yeah.
I'm looking at medical professionals that are just overwhelmed. On the hospital floor, RNs had 4 patients each. Well, that doesn't sound like much, but we were also in a moderate care, what's called total care system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's round-the-clock care for patients that need, you know, round-the-clock monitoring. 4 patients would seem to be about the level that they could handle. Anything more than that, I saw them handle 5 on occasion. They're pretty much spending the entire shift running, and they ran 12-hour shifts.
Wow. Yep.
In the SNF, the RNs are handling 11 patients each.
Really?
But we're not talking about total care. We're not talking about, you know, 20. There is someone there 24 hours, but they're not being managed 24 hours.
Oh, okay. Sure.
So, you know, they're not sitting on IVs, they're not on monitors for 24 hours and such. So they can do things. And, you know, this idea that was a banner that floated, the idea of cutting, you know, the government by 5%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a joke.
Oh,
that
yeah.
is honest joke. I'm a big fan of the Defense Department. So are you.
Yep.
We're certainly not interested in, you know, doing unnecessary cuts in the military because, frankly, it tends to roll downhill.
Exactly.
But I, you know, somebody did say something, and I knew it was a lot, but I didn't think about exactly how many numbers. We have 800 bases around the planet.
Yes.
800 bases. I can't think of a reason in the world why we don't need more than a dozen.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You know, if we still had Subic Bay, which we don't, we have Okinawa, Ramstein in Germany, Thule in Greenland, Diego in the Indian Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
I'd pull just about everyone else out of just about everywhere else.
Yeah.
And you could probably do a pretty significant cut in the military. And you could bring them back onto American soil and close military bases you know, and open up some of those bases again and spend the money here, having the bases open.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And have a pretty good production.
Yep.
I'm 5% is not even close. And I'm talking about 5% from like 2007 or 2006 levels. I'm not talking 5% from last year's level, which would be.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Tell me he's not doing that. I only heard the number. Tell me he's not talking about reducing, you know, this fiscal year's numbers by 5%.
Because that is unclear. I do not recall reading or hearing a year associated with that cut number.
Because
that
frankly,
would lead me to believe that that's a current account rather than a retrospective account. But I haven't heard it.
If it's 5% of what Obama's done in the last year and a half, you know, that's not even a joke. That's a fucking insult.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody said, and I don't know if it was Boehner, but somebody said we need to take spending back to the 2007 level. And I'm saying, if you are proposing that as a start, not as an end point, but as a start, okay, you bet. We can work with that. If they're proposing that as an end point, no, I'm sorry. We have a whole lot of Bush-era excesses to get rid of also.
Who was it today? Was it Mark Levin that said, or was it Savage or somebody? I'm flipping with two radio stations now that have... I can pretty much go now from 7 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night listening to a conservative...
Wow, cool.
Between the two major talk stations, radio out here in San Diego, I can be pretty much nonstop conservative all the way across the day.
Wow.
But they've got them all. I mean, you know, Levin, Savage, Hannity, Rush, and three of our local guys are all pretty conservative. You know, it covers the whole range. In any case. Somebody said that the EPA has gone up 129% in the last year.
No, wait, say that again?
The EPA's budget has gone up 129%.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Okay? If you want to go back to 2007 levels, I hope that's, you know, there are probably some portions of the budget that have gotten just that are not 15 or 20%, which is what the total is. There are probably some that have gone up 1 or 2%, and others that have gone up, you know, like the EPA, 129%. That's just ridiculous.
Exactly.
I started reading something to you just before the show came on, and it was something rather interesting. And this is what the question was. The headline is an ATM cash shortage coming? And this was an email. George, I work with a business partner in Region Redacted. We have combined between us 180 ATM machines that we service. In order to do this, we need to order money, 20s only, from several banks on a weekly basis. This is a considerable amount weekly, almost $400,000 plus. Here's the interesting piece that's developing. In the past 4 weeks, four of the major banks have informed us that they can no longer provide us with the cash for our business. Now the problem is that it's our money we're taking out of the bank. So speaking with bank personnel on the side, my question was this. What's going on? How come we cannot take our money out? The answer? They're not authorized to hold, carry, have on hand any more than a certain amount of cash. The amount we're getting, even though it's out of our own account, they cannot order or have on hand that amount of cash at any time now. I'm not talking small banks. I'm talking about large money center banks. Now, you were in banking.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a client that was depositing $500,000 a week into your accounts and taking out $400,000 a week in cash for their ATM machines,
mm-hmm.
and the federal government said, you may no longer maintain sufficient cash to support your clients. You may only maintain $250,000 in cash or $180,000 in cash. What would you be doing besides having a cow?
Well, yeah. Important to distinguish here, though, because from at least from what you read to me, it isn't apparent that the Fed is doing this. Now, every branch of every bank has a cash limit. I had one all of the years that I managed a branch. There was a cash limit that you didn't go over, other than if you could justify it by saying, I know I'm going to have a big withdrawal from this account in this kind of an amount. And then depending on how the delivery days worked, then and typically we ordered cash once a week, delivered on
right.
Tuesdays. So depending on how the delivery dates went, you could exceed your cash limit in your branch. So it would be interesting to know, was this a Fed limitation or a state banking regulatory in the event of a state chartered bank, or is this a bank limit and they're big enough that they don't care?
Well, the thing that I note in there regarding your point, your question, is that he's talking about they order the money from multiple banks.
Yeah. Yep.
And four of the major banks have informed us that they can no longer provide us.
Okay.
But we're talking about money center banks.
Yeah.
Different bank companies, you know, over a fair geographical, well, after probably a fairly limited geographical area.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm suggesting that if they're money center banks, that's Fed.
No. That's not a good assumption to make.
Okay.
You
would know better on that area.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it isn't. All I'm saying is you can't make that assumption based on what you got there. It would be interesting to find out. It would also be interesting to find out, are they banking with the headquarters bank branch, or are they banking with, like in my case, a podunk town branch of a much larger bank? It would be interesting to know that.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to be able to find that information out.
Yeah.
So, it was just an interesting point because
yep.
it kind of goes to this idea that what is the Fed doing with QE2?
Well, yeah. One further point to this thing. These guys are obviously operating a private ATM system, and you
right.
see those all the time. You see them in Safeway, you see them in all kinds of places. It could be that those banks are saying, you know what, these people are kind of encroaching on our turf. And we don't get any fees out of that. So why should we go to the expense of having that kind of cash on hand to give to them? so that they can operate a profit-making business without getting any kind of a cut off of it?
Well, I'm sure if they're sitting on a lot of cash, there's some interest sparing going on.
Not really, right? I mean, well, and in today's interest rate environment, that's like nil, which gets exactly back to this QE2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or whichever one it is.
I've been fighting this idea. You and I haven't talked much about it, and I'm poo-pooing a little bit the idea of hyperinflation all the cash that's being thrown out there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we haven't talked about this, have we?
We haven't talked about it in probably a year. Maybe a little bit less than that, but not much.
Here's the reason why I don't think it's necessarily hyperinflative.
Okay.
For the last 20 years, something has been going on that has made the Fed's ability to manage money and therefore interest rates much more problematic for the Fed. It used to be that the amount of currency in circulation was in direct proportion to the amount of debt that was outstanding. And the Fed could, by changing the amount of money in circulation, have a direct impact on the amount of debt and therefore the interest rates that were being channeled around. But in the late 1980s, Michael Milken, to his everlasting benefit, I shall honor him forever, came up with a way for non-Fed, non-banking institutions to literally create money.
We've done that forever.
Well, in his case, it allowed companies like GM to literally create money.
Sure. Every bank does that, Tracy.
Yes, the banks do it.
Yeah.
But he changed it from banks. He took it out of the control of the banks. Now companies can do it. Hell, you and I can do it. If we had enough things going on. The Fed doesn't have control over as much of the debt that's being created out there, and hence currency fluctuations have less of an impact on interest rates and the debt loads. When a company can say, I'm going to create $1 trillion worth of debt, securitize it, and recapitalize it, and the all outside of the Fed's hands, that's a lot of, GDP that's going to be impacted that the Fed doesn't have any control over. Now,
I don't know that it impacts GDP, but it certainly impacts
interest
rates
and inflation.
Well, interest rates and currency, yeah. Absolutely.
Now, Milken and company who took this idea and ran with it in the late 1980s and early 90s, were dealing with millions and occasionally hundreds of millions of dollars. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the hedge funds in the late 1900s and all through the 1990s and all through the 2000s, we're dealing with hundreds of billions of dollars and in some cases trillions of dollars. The Fed has literally 1,000 times more debt sitting on top of the existing currency base than there was before.
Mm-hmm.
We're wiping out very large chunks of that debt, simply because we're just wiping out the asset base that goes with it. The problem with that is you could throw a lot of money at it and you're not going to support it because, we're running from a number that's so large that you could literally be printing money every second of every day, out of every printing press in there, and you still wouldn't be able to keep up with the fact that we're burning, asset and debts still, huge chunks of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I have both talked about the fact that this is not a liquidity crisis. You can throw as much money at it as you want, and it doesn't make any difference.
That's true. That's absolutely
and
true.
that's realistically speaking, the only tool the Fed has is to create money to throw at a problem. And that is the least of our problems. We have a solvency problem, not a liquidity problem. And I think that as long as we continue to have the debt overhang we do, and that number is still in the hundreds of trillions of dollars, that you're not going to get hyperinflation until we've burned some of that off. Not some. A lot of it off, regardless of how much money gets printed. But here's my problem. Now, so I'm not worried about, you know, or the government $1 trillion worth of, okay, and how much that worth it devaluing. You know, and I heard Beck today, and I heard Hannity today, and they're all talking about how we're devaluing the dollar because of doing this. You know, because inflation is just going to eat away, and I'm sitting there going, not a problem. You know, if this was a liquidity problem and you're overthrowing money, throwing more money at it, then you're right. Absolutely right. But, you know, trying to, you know, we've gone from a 4% monetary base to a 0.004% monetary base, you know, and you can throw money at that all day long, and it's going to take you a long time to get back up to that 4%.
Mm-hmm.
And so my problem is I don't have a problem with inflation. But this is where I think, this is why I support everyone's complaint about what the Fed is doing. What the Fed is doing with all this cash is they're alleviating the pain that the banking system is feeling for doing things really badly. And when somebody feels pain, that's the body's way of telling you to stop doing whatever you're doing.
Yes, that's true.
When banks don't feel the pain because the Fed is covering for them, which is what the Fed is doing here,
mm-hmm.
The banks have no reason to stop. And right now, until we get rid of that debt overhang, you know, there's no reason for the banks to stop because at interest rates the way they are right now, the banks have every reason in the world to continue doing what they're doing, which was to take 0.1% of interest and using a substantial amount of debt, you know, build, you know, some kind of reasonable return.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Fed's keeping the interest rate at practically nothing, which means, and it's protecting the bank's losses, which means there's nothing to stop the banks from continuing to do what they were doing.
Exactly.
This moral hazard, you know how I feel about morals.
Yes, indeed, me too.
This moral hazard is, in fact, in my opinion, much worse than a fear of inflation. Because it's a fear of continuing to do what got us in this position in the first place. You know, frankly, I'd prefer to have out-of-hand inflation. Because you know what the Fed would be doing and the banks would be doing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they would be slicing and dicing, you know, debt left, right, and center. They wouldn't be doing what they're doing now, which is continuing the problem that got us here.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
While I disagree with the particular focus, the problem is in fact the same. The Fed's QE2 program continues to protect the banks. It continues to, you know, give legs to the idea of moral hazard, and it prevents the system from getting rid of the debt overhang that absolutely needs to be gotten rid of because of the solvency issue.
Right.
The inflation
exactly.
issue is a simplistic look at, you know, the overall marketplace. And let me tell you, as a monetarist, someone that really likes Milton Friedman and monetary theory, that was probably the most difficult thing for me to get over the last few years.
Hmm.
You know, is to look at the fact that his theories in today's environment are practically useless.
Hmm.
It used to be the Fed had a really big lever to be able to do things.
Sure.
And now what they've got is a plastic spoon, and they're trying to lift a car.
Yeah.
I don't care how much leverage they've got. It's a plastic spoon.
Yeah.
And they're trying to lift a car. So
the other analogy I've heard is they don't have any arrows left in their quiver.
Yeah, they don't. I mean,
yeah, I know.
their only controlling lever was, dumping currency into the system, dumping reserves into the system, and adjusting the interest rate. Well, they're paying interest on the reserves, which, and that interest is greater than they can get anywhere else. So the only thing that's going to happen is banks are going to throw, continue to build reserves. There's no good reason, for them to lend. And anybody in their right mind that's borrowing money at this point, they're not in their right mind.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yep.
All right,
I agree.
Have one more thing.
Okay.
We talked a little bit about the Palin impact, and, it was extensive last week.
Oh, yeah.
We're definitely seeing the GOP trying to walk back from some of its campaign promises. Surprise.
Yeah, right. Keep your eye on them, folks.
Yeah, the Fed's QE2 is not making the Chinese or the Germans happy. Surprise. But I do have to say, heard Obama say a couple things in the last, couple days that just continues to reinforce the idea that the man is clueless.
Mm-hmm.
Or he is so deep in denial that, send the man a scuba tank. You go to ground or be deeper. One of the things he said was, I was surprised by the amount of the political cost for doing Obamacare.
Mm-hmm. He did say that.
Now, you had to be in a fucking box in the bottom of the ocean not to realize that Obamacare was absolutely energizing the right, in such a way as to, guarantee that they were going to come to the ballot box.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, you couple that statement with Nancy Pelosi's statement, we have to pass it so you can find out what's in it. Knowing that the federal government always and will forevermore have unintended consequences regardless of the legislation that they pass. And you get that cluelessness that he expressed.
And so the question is he clueless or is he in denial?
Hmm.
Or is he so insulated in that White House, that he's not getting any kind of sense of what's going on?
Well, God, I mean, I cannot believe that the Democrat office holders in Congress, whether they be senators, but more probably representatives, because representatives generally have a whole lot more town halls than senators do. But I can't believe that they did not report back to their leadership in Congress, and that their leadership did not, in fact, report back to the White House. I mean, I would find that absolutely astounding if that were the case. And if they did that accurately, given the incredible outcry from summer of 08 through 09, all the way up to the election day, if they reported that back accurately, then it's got to be denial. Can't be clueless,
right,
because we gave them a clue.
Yeah, we're going to have to pick this up. You got 15 seconds.
Hey, thank you, Mama Gurkha, Arkansas Traveler, Louisa Mom, Hallie 5, if you're there. Thanks for listening in. We appreciate it.
All Buzz Zero, I saw you come up. Thanks. Everyone else, we'll see you next week. Green Room, short
Green Room.
Again. All
so,
kinds of
I, you know, that's an interesting question, Tracy. I mean, you know, denial or clueless? God. I can't believe that they're clueless, but maybe they were. So maybe it's a combination of both.
Well,
I don't know.
You tie it in with the bowing to the heads of state, you know, the gifts to the queen,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you tie that in, and you go, this isn't a matter of political tin earness. This is a large segment, a large chunk of, you know, complete, oh, I don't know. I mean, I can't imagine that he's that stupid. What scares me more is that there is right now an entire administration,
mm-hmm.
you know, populated by people that appear to be that stupid.
There is another explanation. Don't give a damn.
Oh, well. You know, the problem with that is they have to assume that they have sufficient power in their hands to be able to overrule anything else that should come their way. And, you know, if Obamacare didn't prove one thing, that even when the Democrats have control of the House, the Senate, and the presidency, they can't accomplish much at all. What they can accomplish is pretty damn bad, but, you know, Obamacare is not that it is a step towards nationalization of the healthcare system, which it is.
Mm-hmm.
That is that they have littered the entire field with, you know, landmines for Democrats and Republicans and anybody else that, you know, even begins to peel back some of the layers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a monstrosity that, you know, Democrats are going to be shaking their heads at for years.
Yes, I agree with that.
I mean, you know, the Democrats are going to go, well, we can't do this. We really can't do this. Yeah, I know I voted for it. We can't do this. You know,
that brings up a really interesting possibility. I mean, the current thinking is this. Yeah, the Republicans can try to defund it, which will set up a, if not a constitutional crisis, a governance crisis, because the only way to do that is via the budget. And they can send a budget, they can make up a budget, defunding, send it to the House, or I'm sorry, send it to the Senate. The Senate says, no, we don't agree with that. So Senate passes whatever their version of that is. And then they go to conference committee. So assume that the Republicans in the House hold firm. You get a government shutdown. Or, alternatively, the Senate says, yeah, okay, fine, great, we'll do that. Sends that budget bill to the president vetoes it. Now, the interesting thing to me is, and I have only just thought of it, is if there are sufficient Democrats in the Senate, and that's possible in the Senate, I don't think it's possible in the House, but it is possible in the Senate, if there are sufficient Democrats in the Senate that will sign off on that along with the Republicans, that puts Barack Obama in a really hard spot, because now you've got a bipartisan budget that defunds what he considers his signature moment, and he's got to figure out, can he or can he not veto that, and what did it pass by?
Well, okay. Let's assume for a second that the House does pass a bill to repeal it.
No, no.
Okay.
I don't think, well, I mean, yeah, they can do that, but I don't think that's what they're going to try. But, yeah, okay, go ahead. Assume that for a second.
For a second. Okay. We've got 46 votes in the Senate.
Yep.
Maybe we'll have 48. So let's call it 40.
Maybe.
Means we only need 5 Democrats, you know, that either, you know, that will be up for re-election in
2012. Yep.
And who just watched, you know, the Senate Majority Leader save his seat by the hair on his chinny chin chin.
Yep.
And oh yeah, you know, enough union malfeasance to keep the courts busy for a decade.
Exactly.
And, you know, all the Tea Parties need to do is to have, you know, 3 or 4 more Mark Rubio-type candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And let's face it, they're coming.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, they are coming. You know, the Tea Party movement... I don't want to see the Tea Party because it's not a Tea Party. The Tea
right.
Party move is probably going to put together another 30 or 40 solid House candidates and probably another half a dozen to a dozen Senate candidates that are going to be running against Democrats and RINOs. You know, I think we could certainly get 5 Democrats to jump ship and pass it and send... Knowing that Obama's going to veto it,
mm-hmm.
I think we can get really easy.
Hmm.
You know, because they, you know, they'll go to the to read and go look.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Obama's going to veto this. I'm going to go ahead and vote for this because 2 years from now, you're safe for the next 6 years. But 2 years from now, I'm going to be in for my life.
Mm-hmm.
If
mm-hmm.
I don't vote for this. You know, I may as well just spend the next 2 years building up whatever war chest I can because I'm either going to lose bad or I'm just not going to even fight it.
Yep.
Because he might not make even the primaries. I think Reid will say, go ahead, because it's no, you know, it's going to be vetoed. And then, you know, Obama gets to veto it. Now the question is there 7 or 8 more Democrats on there? Because imagine if, you know, 8 or 9 Democrats sign it, you know, and it goes with 56 or 57 Senate signatures to it. You know, now he vetoes it, and the House overrides the veto.
Well, but the Senate has to also.
Right. But if the House overrides the veto, and
okay.
56 or 57 senators signed off on the bill, the repeal to begin with,
mm-hmm.
you know, we only have to peel 5 more of them off to override the veto.
Hmm.
Is that all we have to do, or do we need 66?
Yeah,
we
got to have 66. Yeah, got to have 66, 2/3.
And that won't happen.
No.
Never mind.
No.
That was 10 minutes that we didn't talk about.
Well, yeah, I know. But it's good to go through the exercise to think the thing through. I'm thinking that we probably get to a government shutdown thing. But in my view, that's not necessarily bad.
I agree. And I don't think, you know, there's going to be no backlash against Republicans from the Republican side.
Nope. And if the polls are accurate, and the last poll that I saw said 56% want Obamacare repealed, I don't think they get a heck of a lot of a backlash from the big middle, the independents, because that number is even higher. So then it becomes how can you spin it, and that's going to be critical. I mean, the messaging on that thing is going to be critical to who caused the shutdown. I mean, I remember when it shut down before and the Republicans got the blame, even though they weren't the ones that were at fault. but that's the way the narrative went, and so how do you fight that? So then,
well, you know, here's the other side of that. There's an entirely new source of information that is not controlled.
That's true. Yes.
You know, could the Tea Party have existed without the internet?
No.
No, I agree.
Yeah, I'm just no way in hell.
And so, you know, I don't think you can get a whole lot of narratives passed through anymore unless it's supported by the internet in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, we're much more energized than the left.
Absolutely. Although, interesting to me, and I don't know how much you've been on Twitter the last 3 or 4 days.
Not.
Okay. There's a real lack of people around talking about anything. I mean, it's slowed down a lot.
Well, that I understand.
Sure.
You know that happened after 2008. I mean, you know, everyone was tired of dealing with it. They just didn't, you know, let's get away from politics for a while.
Sure.
You know, because we've been politics now pretty heavy for the last 18 months, but certainly in the last 3 months it's been wall-to-wall, everything.
Yep,
politics.
Absolutely, yes.
You know, I think people just want to get back to their own little lives and their own little sanity levels for a while.
Well, I'm hoping it's for just a little while. I mean, that's what I'm hoping.
I, in the meantime, have been spending a lot of time at the hospital, obviously.
Yes, you have.
But it's for me when I'm there, it's dead time. I can't do work, right?
Right.
Well, I've been working on the book. And I have begun draft 2, you know, my second redraft,
mm-hmm.
About 185 pages at this point. And it's going to be much bigger. I'm estimating it's going to be somewhere around 3 1/4, somewhere in that 350.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, I'm going to read you the last part of my intro.
Okay.
I've actually drafted 2 intros, one to the first part and one to the second part. But I'm going to read you the last couple paragraphs of the intro.
Okay.
Looking back at the writings of Hobbes, Locke, Paine, Jefferson, and Mill, the thread is there to follow. Man, beast that he is, was the source of legitimate government and authorities. If a system of constraints could be formulated that would limit his more base passions without creating despots and tyrannies, the result would benefit all mankind. Jefferson had the clearest vision, quote, that all men are created equal, they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, unquote. But on this point, he was very wrong. Quote, we hold these truths to be self-evident, unquote. In 2008, I was challenged during an online debate, in its entirety in part one, to state my system for determining what rights were correct and which were no more than the rantings of a lunatic or the justification of a tyrant. Part two is my attempt to meet that challenge. In his Introduction to Common Sense, 1776, Thomas Paine offered more hope for his point of view than I do mine. Perhaps the sentiments contained in the following pages are not yet sufficiently fashionable to procure them general favor. A long habit of thinking a thing of not thinking a thing wrong gives it the superficial appearance of being right and raises at first a formidable outcry in defense of custom. But the tumult soon subsides. Time makes more converts than reason. unquote.
Hmm.
That's the end of my intro to one.
Mm-hmm.
It is a rather interesting process to read Hobbes, Locke, and Paine at this point, because they are speaking to today.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
They are speaking today. And my problem is that the left simply is not interested in hearing about it at all. But my problem is the right is being really selective in what it's listening to.
Hmm.
Paine's quote, the following statement opens up, is part of his beginning of the Rights of Man. I use it at the beginning of the intro. And I'm going to read just the first two sentences, and you're going to kind of go, well, this is today. Quote, "The enormous expense of governments has provoked people to think by making them feel, and when once the veil begins to rend, it admits not of repair." Duh. I mean, if I couldn't use that today, there's no better time that it couldn't have been used for. I mean, you know, it's just, I read that and I went, let me clear up the English a little bit and put a little more slang into it, and I could plagiarize this, and it would still be applicable today.
Sure. Yeah.
The last part of that intro is, "Though man may be kept ignorant, he cannot be made ignorant." The Tea Party is no longer ignorant. And no amount of effort by the rhinos, the Democrats, or the mainstream media is going to make them ignorant once again. Yamamoto said it at the end of, the attack against Pearl Harbor. I'm afraid we have awakened a sleeping giant.
Mm-hmm, 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 mm-hmm. Yeah.
The worst thing Barack Obama could have done, or in my opinion, your opinion, and a few other people, the best thing he could have done, is that he has given voice to a citizenship that is re-energized to being responsible citizens. And frankly, that's the last thing a politician in Washington wants.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
From either political party.
Yep. Yep, yep.
Although, and that's one of the reasons I don't think we're going to go, I don't think it's going to go away.
Yeah. It is interesting for me to note that there are a number of, and they are Tea Party movement types, who got elected to office that had never run for an office before, one. Two, won their primary and the general, and they go in as actual citizen legislators.
Yep.
That's going to bring a really unique view. And I'm not sure it's a view that is going to be welcomed in some quarters.
And those quarters would make a very serious mistake to assume because they are citizen legislators
mm-hmm.
that they are rubes. Because
mm-hmm.
most of them are going to know more about the Constitution and how this country should be run, than the people that have been there for 20 years. They might be able to say, that's not how Congress works. These people are going to come in and say, yeah, we understand that. Now let's get it back to the way it was supposed to be.
Yeah, right. Let's get it back to the way it's supposed to be. Yeah. Now, how effective they're going to be, who knows? I mean, way too early to tell that. I mean, they aren't even seated yet. But it's gonna be some interesting times, I think. And I kind of like what Hillbuzz is putting out, talking about the GOP cocktail party. I'm kind of adopting that for my own use also, because it's really kind of apropos. I don't know where Boehner fits into that. I think he's kind of a semi cocktail party guy. John Cornyn certainly is. No doubt in my mind. But you know what? Boehner isn't, but John Cornyn and some of those guys, they're old. And I'm wondering, as part of the 2012 thing, if we can get some young ones like Marco Rubio, like Kristi Noem, like Michelle Bachmann, if we can get some of those people in there, younger, kind of have a little bit different viewpoint, we aren't going to do ourselves any harm.
No. As long as they can't be co-opted, and I'm pretty... There's a bunch of those. Del Rubio, I don't believe can be.
Boy, it'd be pretty hard.
It'd be pretty hard.
Yeah.
Mainly because, you know, they owe their lifeblood to people like you and me.
Well, not only that, but
they've got it in their heart. They've got the right principle in their heart.
Exactly.
You know, you and I have been saying this for the last 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, give me a politician with principles, and I'll show you one that's going to vote for us all the time.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And you know, the ones that I think of, like the Marco Rubios, like the Kristi Noems, like the Michelle Bachmanns. And I guess to borrow a phrase from Sarah Palin, you know, they truly do have a servant's heart. You know? I mean, they just... I don't know what that means for any longevity, because part of that is I came in to do a job, I'm going to do that, but I'm not going to do that forever.
Right.
Somebody else needs to step up too. But we're going to have a really great crop of people ready to step up, given what happened in the state legislatures.
Yep. We should see a lot of people picking up some serious, you know, experience in the process.
Absolutely.
And seeing where principals are getting them versus, you know, going along to get along.
Yeah, God, I hate that phrase, but it's absolutely true. And it's one of the things that I like about the fairly new argument that I'm hearing about earmarks. It isn't that earmarks are such a huge part of the budget. I mean, because they're not. They're pretty minuscule in total. But what they allow you to do is buy votes.
Right. Corrupts the process.
Yep. And anything that slows down and hinders that corruption of the process, I'm for it. I'm for it.
Yep.
Yes, indeed.
All right.
Okay, kiddo. I will talk to you next week. Have a really great rest of the week.
You too. Thanks, Bill. Everyone
Alrighty.
Else following.
Yep.
Have a good week, and we'll talk to you next week.
Bye, all.
Thank you.